From WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio Boston, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. The White House budget plan for fiscal year 2020 is out. It's a record $4.7 trillion ask, but science agencies and activities take cuts almost across the board. The president envisions an EPA budget cut by almost a third, a decrease of more than 10% at the Department of Energy and the National Institutes of Health. NASA's total funding would hold steady, but with more money going toward establishing a presence on the moon and less toward understanding Earth. Here to help make sense of all the numbers is Matt Horahan. He is the director of the R&D Budget and Policy Program for the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Matt, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
This time last year, we were talking about a White House budget plan that, in your opinion, prioritized spending cuts over all else and was willing to sacrifice science in the name of a smaller budget. This year, we've got a record big ask, the title of the budget, something like a budget for a better America. What's your take home from this budget plan?
Well, there are a lot of similarities between this budget and some of the prior budgets that we've seen from this administration. Like previous budgets, this budget seeks to cut back on non-defense spending in order to boost defense spending. And like previous budgets, it cuts across a great many areas, including science. And within science, it makes quite a few cuts. And in fact, this is an even tougher budget than we got last year. There were some positive elements to last year's budget. Last year's budget sought to hold steady on quite a few basic science programs within agencies like the National Science Foundation or the National Institutes of Health. This year's budget does away with some of those goals and actually makes some pretty sizable cuts, or would make some pretty sizable cuts to those agencies and others.
We should emphasize that this is the president's proposal. It did not end up being anything close to what Congress passed last year. And already we've been hearing from Congress that they don't think this is what we'll end up with as a final budget. But just talking about what this proposal says, perhaps about the priorities of the administration, interesting that the National Science Foundation, which funds a lot of earth and environmental science, pretty much holds steady, less than a 1% cut. But the National Institute of Health, which funds a lot of biomedical research, which seems to be an area of bipartisan support, something that President Trump even brought up in the State of the Union. There we're seeing a 10 or 15% cut in the budget proposed. What do you make of that?
Sure, yeah. NIH would see a cut of about 12%. You mentioned the National Science Foundation. They'd also receive a cut of about 12%. So, as I said, we're seeing some pretty steep cuts across the board, even in areas where there has historically been quite a bit of bipartisan agreement. That would include, for example, cancer research. Both Democrats and Republicans have for many, many years been wholeheartedly behind funding cancer research. The current budget would drop cancer research funding by about $900 million below the current year. That's a pretty sizable cut, again, on the order of 10 or 12%.
And again, pretty interesting, given that the president did in his State of the Union set curing childhood cancer as a goal.
That's right. That's right. And in fact, the budget does prioritize pediatric cancer. There is a new initiative within NIH that would increase pediatric cancer research by about $50 million. And so naturally, the administration is focused on that new initiative, as part of their message. But again, that comes in the context of fairly massive cuts to other forms of cancer research.
Matt Horahan, another place where the White House proposes some pretty dramatic cuts is the Department of Energy. Again, a place where there's pretty bipartisan support for the research activities of the Department of Energy, but those take a hit from the White House. I mean, there's a lot of disagreement on these issues.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you've got a couple different elements within the Energy Department. You've got the basic science programs, which tend to get a bit more bipartisan support. And there, the real priorities for the administration, and these are shared priorities between the administration and the Congress, are advanced computing, exascale computing, quantum information science. I mean, these are areas that the White House would like to see funding increases, and Congress is entirely likely to provide those increases this year, depending on how some other larger factors shake out. But outside of those few areas, basic science within DOE would drop by about 16 or 17%. So again, these are incredibly sizable cuts, similar to what we've seen in prior years from this administration. On the applied side, now that's the basic science part of the Energy Department. They also fund quite a bit of applied technological research on efficiency, renewables, nuclear energy, fossil energy. And these areas have always been a target for the Trump administration, especially the Office of Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy. It funds $2 to $3 billion a year in low-carbon energy R&D. The Trump administration would do away with about 70% of their funding in this budget. And those programs tend to be a bit more controversial, a bit more partisan. But again, as you mentioned earlier, the administration has been trying to cut those programs back dramatically for a few years now, and so far they have not succeeded.
Well, on the same theme, I mean, the biggest percentage-wise proposed cut in this budget plan is the EPA. Again, the White House proposing a 31% cut to the EPA budget. This is basically what they asked for last year, although interesting that the total amount they're asking for this year is a little bit more than actually what they asked for last year. But again, asking for this 30% cut that they didn't get from Congress last year.
Sure, that's right. That's right. EPA, they'd scale back EPA. They'd scale back the U.S. Geological Survey. They'd scale back NASA Earth Science. And these are all, to varying degrees, repeats of past requests. And I think it says something about the relatively enduring support within the Congress for science programs that these requests to cut back these programs have not really gone anywhere. And I think you'd expect with the Democrats now in control of the House that even further reduces the odds that the Trump administration is going to succeed in achieving these funding cutbacks.
We saw last year a push to get more legislators with science backgrounds into office with the Democrats in control of the House. Now we've got Representative Eddie Bernice Johnson, a nurse by training, longtime representative from Texas, leading the House Science, Space and Technology Committee. We've seen climate science hearings in recent months. Do you feel like there's a strong pro-science feeling in Congress at this point?
I mean, I don't know that there is a particularly pro-science feeling now any more than there has been historically, at least when it comes to funding. I mean, one of the little known facts about the federal budget and the federal science budget is that it's actually been fairly steady over many decades.
Matt Hourihan is the director of the R&D Budget and Policy Program for the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Matt, thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure.
We're going to take a short break here. That means you've got a minute and a half to cut a grape in half, put the two pieces next to each other in the microwave, and watch the sparks fly. We'll explain what's going on when we come back. This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. It's not every day that a scientific study reads like a work of literature, but here's how a recent paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences began. Quote, "It is a truth universally acknowledged that a pair of grape hemispheres exposed to intense microwave radiation will spark, igniting a plasma." That's right. Cut a grape in half, put the pieces next to each other in the microwave, and voila, sparks and maybe even a glowing cloud of plasma. You can find videos and explainers online, but there's never been a solid scientific explanation for the phenomenon until now. Aaron Slepkov is Associate Professor and Canada Research Chair in the Physics of Biomaterials at Trent University and senior author on a new study explaining why microwaved grapes produce plasma. Aaron, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me on, Heather.
I understand this microwaving grapes trick has been around for a couple of decades. You can find YouTube videos going all the way back to the beginnings of YouTube, but I'm, for one, just finding out about it, and I did it for the first time a few days ago, and it was pretty spectacular. I mean, you put the grapes in there next to each other, the grape halves, couple of seconds, there's a few sparks, and then there was actually this like cloud, almost like a cloud of sparks above the grapes. Pretty big, too. I mean, what are we actually looking at there?
Well, there's two parts to it. The most impressive part that everybody's interested in at home is the big, cloud of plasma that you mentioned. But once you have a spark in a microwave, often that spark will grow into a much bigger plasma because because any plasma, any charged ions or electrons are actually resonant with the microwave radiation themselves. So they feed on microwave radiation. So once you get a spark, it often will grow into a big, you know, ball lightning. So that's the impressive second part. We are very happy to have found out why the sparking happens to begin with. And that's been the crux of our research, is explaining why the microwave will create a spark from a pair of grapes.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, you did this work because there were explanations, some explanations online that you didn't really think held water. What was missing from what people said was going on in this little parlor trick?
So for decades, I think it was assumed that when you cut the grape in half and you leave this little connecting bridge of skin, that the bridge of skin acts as a conductor, as a conducting channel, almost like a piece of metal. And so that the balls of the grapes are acting as an antenna. And that did make sense to us. We were just curious about why that's the only geometry that anybody's ever found before. So we went exploring this, and much to our surprise, we found that you don't need the skin of bridge. You can do this with two whole grapes as long as they're very close to each other or touching. And then later, you were right in terms of not holding water. We started thinking as physicists, and as physicists, we always strip things down to their most fundamental basics. And we thought, well, maybe a grape isn't a grape. Maybe a grape to microwave oven is just a ball of water. And so we started studying hydrogel spheres, water beads that are more than 98% water. And we realized that water is a very special material at microwave frequencies. It has what's known as an index of refraction that's very, very large. It's an index of refraction around 10, which is much larger than most materials. And what this means is that the grapes can, or any balls of water, can pack microwave radiation really tightly. They can trap the light inside of them. And so the breakthrough for us was seeing that this is actually about photonics. This is about optics of microwave light as it interacts with geometries of water, rather than about conductive channels in metallic-like objects or conducting grapes.
Okay, so walk me through this. You've got either two grapes or two halves of grapes sitting next to each other in the microwave. In either case, you've got some grape skin touching. You turn on the microwave, they get bombarded with microwaves, and the microwaves just get trapped inside the grapes? That's what you're saying?
So when we have individual spheres, the microwave radiation packs in an interesting way, such that it's hottest right, or more concentrated right in the center rather than more concentrated around the outside. So that was interesting to us from an optical resonance standpoint, but that doesn't explain the phenomenon. The interesting thing is that when you take two spheres and you bring them closer and closer together, the packed light inside of each sphere can sense the other sphere in a sense, and they move towards the point of contact. So by the time that they're touching, almost all of the light is concentrated, almost like as if these were two tiny lenses. They're centimeter size, but microwave radiation is about 12 centimeters. So these look like tiny lenses to the microwave, but they concentrate all of the electric field right at the point of contact. And that's right near the surface where there's lots of sodium and potassium ions in the grapes. And so there's enough intensity of the electric field there to rip off some electrons and to create a plasma.
And if you look at some of your videos that you've taken, or, you know, kind of slow it down, you can actually see the grapes or the grape halves kind of bouncing against each other as this is happening. They're actually moving.
Yes, that was that's something that we did not address in this paper, but that's definitely the avenue of research that we're following up on. We're submitting another paper very shortly about that motion. Somehow there's an exchange of energy from the microwave radiation into some kind of mechanical motion of the vibration. And that's probably has to do with the fact that as the plasma is created, or just before the plasma is created, the temperature is so hot near the surface that it's ejecting violently water vapor, and it's creating a little pressure, a little mini explosion that bounces these apart. And when you watch the videos, you see the plasma goes away when they bounce apart, and then they need to come back together so that you can have this interaction between the two resonators for the spark to happen again. They need to be almost touching or touching for this to happen.
That is really interesting. Would this work? You mentioned that, you know, you have to have two bodies in order for them to kind of sense each other. Would it work with three or four, or is this really specific to just having two?
No, it does work with many others. We haven't investigated fully all of the geometries that work, but if you took, let's say, four grapes, you cut each of them in half, leaving a little skin bridge, you put all eight halves in a row, you're going to get a little xylophone of sparking happening at different locations at different times.
Okay, that I am definitely going to have to try. But what is it about grapes specifically? Is it just their size? I mean, would this work maybe with pitted cherries that are about the same size? Or is there something specific about grapes?
As we found, the most interesting aspect of this is that basically grapes are balls of water. So anything of about the right size, I would say something between 1 centimeter and 2 centimeters in diameter, and it's made of mostly water, will work. We've done this with blueberries. We've done this with cherries. We've done this with olives. Pitted or unpitted, it seems to work because mostly they are balls of water.
Okay, this just gets better and better. I'm talking with physicist Aaron Slepkov of Trent University about recent research on how grapes in a microwave create plasma. You already mentioned that you're following up on this, looking at how the microwave energy creates motion, which you hadn't expected to see. This whole project, I'm wondering, how did this get started? This isn't normally the kind of research that happens in your lab.
You're absolutely correct. We have an ultra-fast laser lab. We do biophotonics in the lab, mostly microscopy. We have a good amount of funding for that research. We certainly hadn't previously sought funding for the grape balls of fire research. It was just a collection of undergraduate students who were interested in doing some science and who there was just no room in the laser lab to have them work. So we gave them this project to play around with, some curiosity-based science, not really knowing if it would go anywhere, but even if we could add something to all of the YouTube interest, we thought it would be worthwhile. And every summer that we worked on this with new undergraduate students, we discovered more and more and more. And at some point, we realized that we probably know the most about this in the world. We've identified certain physics principles that we didn't expect. So then the study turned fairly serious. We started really rigorously trying to do what all scientists should do, and that's disprove our own theories. For example, to disprove that this had to do with surface conductivity, we did this with quail eggs. We put two quail eggs next to each other. They're about the right size. They're a little big, but they're fairly small. And we had a way, we didn't make plasma with them, but we had a way to see if there was a hot spot between them, and there was. And then we stuck a needle in each and took out all of the innards, and we did the experiment again, and the hot spot went away because there's no water inside anymore. And then we refilled them with water and the hotspot came back together. So that was just one way in which we really tried to rigorously disprove the original thought that this had to do with some kind of surface conductivities or ions moving back and forth. And that's just an example of, you know, both serious attention that we pay to it, but also kind of whimsical, because when you get to put quail eggs in a paper, you know you've done something right.
Grapes and blueberries and quail eggs. I mean, and olives. You've maybe got a whole recipe in there somewhere. I have to say, on your website, you mentioned that this was curiosity driven, and you say most of your research is really curiosity driven. And then you kind of put your research into three categories. You've already mentioned the microscopy, that this definitely was not. But then you say there's physics education research, and then just mad science. Where does grapes in the microwave fall in those categories?
For a long time, that was the mad science that we were doing. We've done some other kind of mad science or mad exploration where we once tested a theory that we could use something known as Benford's Law. It's a statistical quirk to see if we could attack multiple choice test banks, for example. So that was part of our education research, but also a little bit of madness. And we published that a few years ago to a little bit of media attention. And so that's the kind of mad science. Just whatever sparks our interest, we try to follow.
You on your CV have an appendix after pages of listing all of your successes, all of your research, your presentations on microscopy and on multiple choice testing, and presumably now you'll be adding grapes in the microwave. And then you've got this appendix that is your CV of failures, all of the papers that haven't been published, the grants that haven't been funded, for that matter, the jobs you've applied for and haven't gotten. Why do you put that there?
Well, that's a good question. You don't see CV of failures very often, but I've been keeping abreast on the internet about various academic matters, you know, the life of academics. And some senior academics have pointed out that junior professors have a sense that the successful senior academics, it's been all roses and all success. And what they don't realize is that for every grant that we get, there's many more that we don't get sometimes. And for every paper that's published, that paper might have had a very arduous path to publication. And so I saw some people putting these CVs of failures up, and I thought, you know what? It's not that I owe it to other people, but that it makes sense to also show how much work we do that never gets to see the light of day. So I started putting the CV of failures, and right now at the top of my CV of failures is this paper where it was desk rejected from four journals before it was published in PNAS. There were four journals that we thought would really like to see this, and you know, they basically wouldn't even send it to review. They didn't think it was interesting, and that certainly felt like failure at the time, but we kept going, and eventually it got published in PNAS, and now I'm talking to you about this. But when a junior scientist sees my CV, they might not appreciate the fact that there's a lot of failures, and that they're part of our curriculum vitae, our way of life as academics. So that's why I've put it up there.
Well, I hope you will take it as a compliment if we call you a mad scientist. Aaron Slepkov is Associate Professor and Canada Research Chair in the Physics of Biomaterials at Trent University, and senior author on a new study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences explaining why microwaved grapes produce plasma. Aaron, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Cannabidiol, or CBD for short, it's a minor constituent of marijuana. It doesn't get you high, but there are some who say it will cure what ails you, no matter what ails you. Medical professionals have a slightly different take. CBD is FDA approved for certain uses, and others are being studied, but there's a lot we don't yet know about CBD. Jenny Wilkerson is assistant professor of pharmacodynamics at the University of Florida. She recently wrote about the growing popularity of CBD and what we actually know about it for theconversation.com. Jenny, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here today.
The title of the article that you wrote for theconversation.com was something along the lines of CBD rising star or passing fad. Let's just jump straight to the punchline. Which is it?
We just don't know yet. There's plenty of science that supports that CBD might have therapeutic indications. Obviously, for intractable pediatric epilepsy, CBD does have clinical validity. However, for all the other claims regarding CBD, we just don't quite know scientifically whether or not it's really going to hold water.
Let's talk about that, the childhood epilepsy issue. CBD is approved by the FDA. I mean, that just came through in June of 2018, fairly recently approved to treat some really severe forms of childhood epilepsy. How did that come about? I mean, how long has that been in the works?
To my knowledge, it's been in the works for quite some time. Initially, clinicians had heard anecdotal information that CBD, that people were willing to try anything to help their children get better from these intractable epilepsies and seizures. And so the company that made Epidiolex, the CBD brand, that the CBD that is FDA approved, realized that there is an overwhelming amount of scientific evidence that, at least in the clinic, that CBD might be helpful for this indication. And so they went through the clinical trials and it became approved last year, as you mentioned.
Do we know how it does that? I mean, it's a pretty amazing drug in that case to be able to cure these seizures that nothing else has worked on.
Yes, so there's been several reports now that indicate that CBD produces its effects through, in at least seizure activity, through serotonin receptors. And so it's interesting because, as I wrote in that article, other types of intractable pediatric epilepsies that are not due to sodium receptor dysregulation, they actually aren't helped at all by CBD. In fact, sometimes they're made worse.
So it seems to be a connection to this serotonin mechanism, which is interesting in and of itself. I mean, Jenny Wilkerson, you study how drugs work in the body, and you say a lot of them work with these receptors, just a protein that kind of grabs the chemical and then does something as a result of that interaction. And CBD is not interacting with the receptors that are actually named for marijuana. They don't interact. It doesn't interact with either of the cannabinoid receptors. It seems to be doing these completely different things. How much do we understand about what CBD does in the body?
So we have a good idea of what CBD does with serotonin receptors for seizure activity. But as far as how CBD works on other receptors in the body, we just don't know yet.
And we should really point out that you mentioned also THC, another chemical that is in marijuana. THC is what gets you high, and CBD doesn't have any of that activity, right? And it's also not considered addictive.
Correct. So there have been several studies and laboratories across the country and around the globe that have shown that CBD does not produce the effects in laboratory settings that are typically associated with drugs that have a high abuse potential, and they do not seem to and CBD does not produce a type of high effect, a psychomimetic effect either.
And in fact, you say that one of the areas that you and many of your colleagues are interested in is figuring out whether CBD could be used, first of all, for pain management that would not be addictive, and possibly even for treating drug addiction. So how would either of those applications work?
So as CBD has been found to act on serotonin receptors, we know that serotonin receptors are really important for pain processing. And so because CBD might be able to modulate activity through serotonin receptors, as well as receptors yet to be discovered on how CBD acts, we think that it might be a very good therapeutic option for people with chronic pain. And we're not quite sure exactly how CBD might be able to counteract the effects of counteract addiction and be used as a therapeutic for addiction. Those mechanisms are a little bit more fuzzy, but we have good preclinical evidence that supports that CBD might, and actually some clinical evidence showing that CBD might be useful as a tool for combating drug addiction.
There are also advocates who say CBD or CBD oil, a version that you can often find on the market, could be good for a host of other things, that maybe we should all be taking CBD on a regular basis just as a baseline anti-inflammatory, that it may have anti-cancer properties. How much do we know about any of these other claims about CBD and its potential health benefits, and for that matter, about any potential long-term side effects?
So that is a great point. So that's exactly what most scientists in the field are concerned about. There's a lot of hype over the CBD products that stems from the thought that it might be the next cure-all for so very many hard-to-manage issues that so many people deal with. However, we just don't know enough exactly about how CBD works with the serotonin receptor. And because different physiological outcomes, such as regulation of sleep and mood, anxiety, and pain, are regulated through complex actions, we just don't know enough to make strong predictions of exactly how well CBD will produce a therapeutic effect in those outcomes. And further, as far as the side effects, to my knowledge, no studies have really been done to look at the long-term effects of using CBD.
What do you think is driving the interest both in the research community and more broadly in CBD at this point? Why has it become such a hot topic now? Is it related to the opioid epidemic, or is there something else?
So it's definitely, the opioid epidemic is definitely, definitely spurring a lot of interest into CBD. And because, as we mentioned, because CBD does not get people high, and the fact that it might be a good therapeutic option for treating opioid addiction, a lot of research is interested into potentially developing CBD as a kind of double shot for treating chronic pain and potentially reducing the needs for opioids and opioid addiction.
How does the interest in CBD, this one chemical component of marijuana that can be separated out and used medically, potentially, relate to the rise also of legalized medical marijuana? I mean, obviously, if you're smoking marijuana, you're also getting the THC. You're also getting a whole lot of other chemicals that are not just the CBD. So what's kind of the overlap in the, you know, the thoughts on that from the medical community?
So marijuana contains over 100 different compounds. We only really know a little bit about, we know the most about THC, the component of marijuana that's going to get you high, and then CBD. And so other than that, there that leaves so many other chemical compounds that we just don't know that much about on how they work. So really, it's actually a very exciting time to work in cannabinoids because there's so many interesting questions that can be asked.
And what is the oversight when it comes specifically to CBD and this, as I mentioned, CBD oil that you can find in stores? What's the oversight on that?
So because hemp-derived CBD is not regulated by the FDA, there is no oversight into the manufacturing process of CBD in all the over-the-counter products. So there's no real oversight.
Jenny Wilkerson, you've mentioned the intense interest in the medical community in learning more about CBD, but even without barriers to research, it takes years to really work your way from a lab all the way through to clinical trials of a potential treatment. For people who have sought out CBD because nothing else seemed to work and really are looking for something right now and say, CBD works for me, it's been helping me, what do you say to those people?
For anyone that's currently using CBD and it's working for you, all I have to say is that's great. I'm very happy that you found something that you think is working. However, because the over-the-counter forms of CBD is not regulated, there's no real way to know exactly what you're spending your money on. And so there's been a lot of consumer reports that show that the actual amount of CBD that is in all these over-the-counter projects is significantly less than what is reported on the label. And then also some of these over-the-counter products contain enough THC to show up on drug tests. And so therefore, using CBD that is out there for a serious medical condition is going to be tough because you don't really know exactly how much and exactly what you are getting. And so for anyone that's using CBD and they think they might be getting an effect, but they don't really know if it's really worth their money, if you don't see an effect with CBD, it could be that you weren't getting the correct dose, or it could be that CBD just simply isn't going to work for whatever is going on with you. Additionally, in the future, if CBD is developed as a therapeutic for a given condition, which is what we're hopeful for, if someone has already tried an over-the-counter CBD product that it didn't work, a person might be less likely to use CBD where it actually could work for them. Another concern that I have for so many patients and so many people that are using CBD, CBD could diminish or enhance the effects of your prescriptions, leading to problems controlling particular medical conditions that were once well managed, or potentially increasing side effects from these other medications. For these points, it's really important to talk to your doctor or pharmacist about potential drug interactions with other drugs before continuing on further with CBD.
Jenny Wilkerson, as a researcher on how drugs work in the body, there are a lot of drugs you could choose to study. What drew you to looking actually at CBD?
Part of the reason why the pediatric intractable epilepsy is such an important thing for me is so actually one of my best friends from back home, her daughter had pediatric intractable epilepsy, and she actually just passed 2 weeks ago from the disease.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, so So that's why I put in that piece about sodium channelopathies versus potassium channelopathies. So my friend's daughter actually had a potassium channelopathy. So my friend tried CBD oil for her child, and it didn't work. Mm. To give a little bit more of a shout out to the research community that I'm involved with. So I first heard about the effects of CBD for pediatric intractable epilepsy at an International Cannabinoid Research Society meeting. And at this meeting, I heard a physician in California talk about how they were treating pediatric patients that had seizure activity that had been previously uncontrolled, that became controlled with use of combinations of THC and CBD. And so that really led me to put CBD in the spotlight for the potential use with my own friend.
Wow. Okay. Well, thank you for sharing that with us.
Absolutely.
Jenny Wilkerson is an assistant professor at the University of Florida. She recently wrote about the growing popularity of CBD, what we know about it, and where research efforts stand. She wrote that for theconversation.com. Jenny, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Up next, large-scale scientific assessment reports have become the norm, but what do they actually do for us? That's up when Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Many of our most important social and political debates have science at their core. Think climate change or genetically modified foods. When policymakers want expert input on these subjects, they often turn to massive synthesis reports known as assessments. Putting one of these together can take years of work by dozens or even hundreds of scientists. And yet, this practice has become so common that the National Research Council alone publishes more than 200 such assessment reports each year. Now, a new book explores the origins of modern scientific assessments and asks whether all these reports are actually doing what we think they are. Naomi Oreskes is professor of the history of science at Harvard University and co-author of Discerning Experts, The Practice of Scientific Assessment for Environmental Policy. Naomi, always great to have you on the show.
Thanks. Great to be back with you, Heather.
Okay, so these expert panels creating these big synthesis reports, I mean, that's really the norm now. We're all familiar with, I think, particularly the climate assessments, whether it's the National Climate Assessment or the UN's, you know, international panel that comes out with a report every few years. But of course, this hasn't always been the case. Where did the modern scientific assessment come from?
Well, what we showed in our book was that there's a long history of society reaching out to experts for opinion on these important kinds of questions. And actually, we begin the book with a discussion of spirit discernment in the Middle Ages. So there were actually expert panels of bishops and priests who were called upon to judge whether or not a person was possessed by the devil. So there's a very long tradition. And so one of the questions we wanted to answer was, how is what's going on now different than what may have happened in the past? And what we showed in the book was that although we could identify earlier forms of activities that we could call assessments of a certain sort, the modern assessment is really a post-World War II phenomenon. And it has to do with two things. One is the growth of science itself, that particularly in the United States and Western Europe, science grew dramatically after World War II. So you just have a lot more scientists doing a lot more work. And that makes it harder for government officials, policymakers to discern what the scientific literature has to say. And then you have the emergence of specific kinds of questions, like you mentioned, climate change, where there's a particular question that has obvious policy relevance. Policymakers need some mechanism to sort through all this different science. And so the assessment emerges as an institutionally sanctioned way to do that.
With some of these questions, and climate change is a great example, where a scientific issue or an issue that has a science component to it becomes really polarized and divisive within the political realm. Is that part of what drove the rise of these panels and big reports, as opposed to maybe a president just turning to a science advisor for advice on a particular issue?
We didn't look specifically at the question of why government officials want assessments. And what we were really trying to get at was, what is an assessment? What are scientists doing? What kind of knowledge do they produce? And how should we as citizens understand that knowledge? So our focus is, we could say, internal to the scientific community, but we do talk a bit in the book about the historical origins. And as you said, one of the things that we can see is that there is an earlier period in which a president or a senator might just turn to scientists they know and ask them a question. And we certainly see this in the archives. I've found letters in the archives where senators wrote to Roger Revelle back in the 1960s and 70s and 80s asking his opinion about climate change. But certainly there's the feeling that begins to emerge, and we see this in the historical record, that it's not really enough just to ask a person, an individual scientist, no matter how smart or good that scientist might be, that there's a need for something that's more structured, that's more organized, that's more systematic, and also, and this is a big part of the story, that is more objective, or at least that's perceived to be more objective. Because if you have a complex issue like climate change or genetically modified organisms, there are many dimensions to the problem. It isn't simply a matter of expertise in one particular area, like atmospheric chemistry. But if we think of climate change, we need to understand atmospheric chemistry. We need to understand ice dynamics. We need to understand ocean heat uptake. And in order to really answer a complex question in its full range of issues, you really can't do that with just one person. And so the assessment becomes a way to bring together the diverse expertise that's relevant to the question, so to look at the question in all of its complexity, and then also to try to aim for a degree of objectivity by not relying on the opinion of just one or two or three people, but getting as many voices, as many relevant voices as possible into the room.
Naomi Oreskes, the name of your book is Discerning Experts, but you have kind of a nickname for this project, which I love, Assessing Assessments.
Right,
a panel of experts looking at how assessments actually work. And you looked specifically, primarily, at three different assessments, one looking at acid rain, one looking at ozone, and then one kind of a subset of the overall climate assessments that we get. And that's specifically looking at the state of the West Antarctic ice sheet. Those are the three modern assessments that you really focused your attention on. But you also kind of make some comparisons to a very early assessment panel going back to the mid-1800s, a British panel of experts that were asked to weigh in on the safety of vaccines, which sounds incredibly relevant still today.
Yes.
One of the interesting things that you point out about that assessment compared to modern assessments is that they actually published a dissenting opinion along with kind of the majority opinion. It sounds more like a Supreme Court decision than a modern scientific assessment, where the goal is typically to find consensus. Where did the idea of consensus as the goal come from? When did that arise?
Well, again, this is a very interesting question. One of the things we see in our work is that the idea of consensus as a goal is a relatively recent phenomenon. We begin to see the word being used more extensively again after World War II. So it seems to be coupled with the rise of large-scale assessments, where you now say it's not enough simply to ask an expert, Heather Goldstone, her opinion. We need to really canvass the full range of scientific opinion. And once you have that, then invariably you're grappling with the issue of scientific disagreement or differences of opinion about how you interpret data. And so out of this idea begins to emerge, or this sort of kind of a consensus about consensus, if you will. Scientists begin to have the view that it's extremely important for them to speak in a single voice, to be univocal, because if they don't, the fear is that this will give the impression that they don't really know what they're talking about, or it will be used or abused by people who want to exploit those differences of opinion. While it's totally understandable, we want to argue that this might actually not be the best approach for two reasons. One is the one that you just alluded to. There is always disagreement in science. It's not realistic to think that scientists will always agree 100% about everything. And the other reason why it's really important is that when people feel they have to come to consensus, it leads to what we would call a least common denominator result. That is to say, I'm in a room with a complex group of people with a lot of different opinions. If we can only say what we all agree upon, then what we all agree upon is going to tend to be somewhat limited. our results may tend to be a bit downplayed. They may be a bit sort of vanilla, to use a metaphor. And we've seen this in the IPCC reports, where there's been a consistent pattern of the reports actually being weak relative to what the scientific evidence was later shown to be true. So we know that a lot of climate change deniers have accused the IPCC of being alarmist, but we have actually shown that the opposite is true. They've actually been extremely conservative.
So, Naomi Oreskes, as you make this argument that perhaps consensus shouldn't be the overarching goal of scientific assessments, what should be the goal? What's the alternative?
Well, I think two things. First of all, if there is consensus, like if there's genuine consensus about certain issues, and almost invariably there is consensus about some things, that should absolutely be articulated. It's extremely important for the public and policymakers to know what it is that scientists are confident they know. And I think one of the problems we've had in the past is there's been a kind of muddling of things that are really quite certain scientifically with other things that are less certain. And the public doesn't always have a clear sense where those boundaries lie. So I think the clear articulation of consensus on settled science is an extremely important role that assessments play. And I think scientists should absolutely continue to do that. In addition, when there are areas where consensus has not yet emerged, and I view consensus not so much as a goal, but as an emergent property. It's something that does over time emerge, in a sense, on its own accord. In areas where that hasn't yet happened, then I think it's extremely important for the scientific community to be clear. And that could mean doing the sort of thing that the 19th Century Vaccine Commission did, which is to say the vast majority of us agree that this is the situation, A, B, C, and D. However, there's a minority that feels otherwise, and we're going to explain that minority view because, you know, it's important for people to be clear about the limits of our knowledge, and because, you know, who knows, maybe they're right. And I think that kind of honesty and transparency would actually help to build the credibility of the scientific community. Because one thing that happens, and I've spoken to scientists who have said this as well, sometimes scientists are afraid that if they express dissent in public, it's like airing your dirty laundry, and that it will actually confuse the public and undermine public confidence. But I think the evidence actually goes the other way, that when people are honest about what they know and what they don't know, that builds confidence, because the public will feel, okay, these scientists aren't trying to pull the wool over us. They're honest about the limits of their knowledge, but here are the things they tell us that they do know. And because they're honest about the limits of their knowledge, we can be confident about the things that they're confident about.
After spending a lot of time looking at what goes on in the process of creating assessments and what they turn out, are you more convinced that this is an important part of the scientific process at this point? Or do you have a diminished sense of the importance and the effectiveness of these scientific assessments?
Definitely more convinced. This was a big question for us in our research group. And when we started this project, we had some pretty strong differences of opinion among ourselves about this issue. And I tended to view assessments more as a kind of summary of existing knowledge that didn't produce new information, and that therefore, in some ways, could be viewed as a bit of a drain on the scientific community. But I have to say, I changed my views. So this is science working as it should. We got new evidence. And I was persuaded by my colleagues and by the data that actually it's more than just a summary. The process of integrating information from many different areas of science yields new insights. There's a kind of whole is greater than the sum of its parts aspect. You know, there's a reason we talk about synthesis, right? That synthesis creates something. We synthesize something. We don't just summarize it. You know, in chemistry, a synthesis produces a new thing. And I think we see that here.
Naomi Oreskes is professor of the history of science at Harvard University and co-author of Discerning Experts, The Practice of Scientific Assessment for Environmental Policy. Naomi, thanks.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on the show.
Until next week, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Funding for Living Lab Radio comes from the Candida Fund, investing in transformative leaders and ideas. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.